Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Darsha Narvaez. She's a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Notre Dame. Her prior careers include professional musician, classroom music teacher, business owner, seminarian, and middle school Spanish teacher. Her current research explores how early life experience influences social culture and moral character in children and adults. She integrates neurobiological, clinical, developmental, and education sciences in her theories and research about moral development. She's the author or editor of numerous books and articles. Her recent book, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom, 2014, won the 2015 William James Book Award from the American Psychological Association. She's the executive director of the Journal of Moral Education. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's really a thrill.
Thank you. So the first question is that you have said that our morality is deficient and not grounded in reality, not grounded in living the earth. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's many issues and layers of response here. For the first point I want to make is that we are raising children in a way that undermines their morality. And we've been doing that for quite some time, probably since agriculture started in the agricultural settled societies. We can see a different kind of moral development in small band hunter-gatherer communities, the immediate return foragers. They raise their children in the way that we evolve to need, and that meets the needs of the baby. And so what happens in societies, so-called civilized societies, is that babies are denied their needs for their own good, according to the cultural kind of ideology that guides the parenting. And what ends up happening then is you have people who have misdeveloped moralities. They're very self-protective because their stress response kicks in very easily. Their brain is not really fully developed because they were so stressed when they were young. And as a result, they get very self-centered. And when you're self-centered, you can't think very communally. You're not very compassionate. You're not very receptively intelligent. And so we have societies of people who have been traumatized by neglect or undercare in early life. Their brains don't work very well. And so they can only think about self-interest. Self-interest seems to be what's normal today in the people we see running our countries. And that is a very perverted kind of morality. Because what we evolved to be is creatures of the earth, like all the other animals on the planet and life forms that live in harmony, with kind of just a thin layer of competition on very thick cake of cooperation that runs the whole natural world. And so we have, by not giving babies what they need and then undermining child development in other ways too, we've shifted what human nature is now. And so we create people who aren't very receptive to non-human being, non-human entities, and they can't conceive of caring about those non-humans because they're so oriented, anthropocentrically focused on themselves because they feel so unsafe in the world very deep down because of what we did to them as babies. And so we've got layers and layers of generations of misdevelopment on top of one another. And so we end up destroying the earth because we can't recognize it. Nobody recognized us as a baby, as our beautiful spirit that wanted to develop in love wasn't recognized. And so we can't then recognize it in others, and especially in non-humans. And so the Western culture in particular has undermined development and then gone into this direction of human superiority, that humans are separate from nature and better than nature, and look how cool we are, and we got all sorts of defenses of the modern society and culture in academics all over the place, as if we are the pinnacle of progress of the Earth's planetary system, and we're actually the strange cancer on the planet. So what I do in my work is try to identify where the points, where we went wrong, and I use the small band hunter-gatherers then as a baseline. People are kind of messed up on what the baseline is to use for human nature, human personality, human morality. And now I'm saying, let's go back to the original baseline. the original instructions, the indigenous worldview and indigenous way of being in terms of small town hunter-gatherer communities. There we see morality, there we see virtue, there we see it developing properly in response to the local landscape, living on the earth as a responsible member of the community.
So I think everything you're saying is really powerful and important and just a fabulous sort of blast introduction to your work. And I'm wondering now if we can step back and talk about how you came to that understanding. And I'm thinking about you know, something I've said in my work so often, and it's something that just baffles me and baffles every activist I know, is we keep thinking, you know, these issues are not particularly cognitively challenging. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the murder of the planet. It's like extraordinary to me that, you know, there are mainstream newspapers are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish. The fish in the oceans could be gone in 30 years, and people aren't freaking out. And for years, I always said, you know, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food in terms of pesticide? And every activist I know, or we can talk about militarism and how, you know, the military ends up with more than 50% of the budget, which just seems really stupid, frankly. So, you know, every activist I know and every person working in these issues just runs up against this notion that goes back to that thing we talked about at the beginning, that the morality is not grounded in, the morality is not grounded in reality. And how did you come to this understanding yourself of, I mean, what are the steps that you went through to get from, wow, people can't really be this stupid, to now I understand how this whole system is working and working with the early childhood?
Well, I've had multiple careers, as you said, but I've always been interested in ethics and morality because I lived in different countries growing up, and I came back to the States and was always shocked by the waste and the grand consumerism and the injustice back in the places I had been living. And so I've always thought about this. And the puzzle to me has been, you know, the Western philosophers that say, oh, all you have to do is reason your way to morality. And if you just make the right decision and then, oh, get your will to follow that decision, then you're going to be a moral person. And it's my experience growing up. I grew up in a harsh family where it was quite stressful for me. I mean, compared to some families, it was mild. But I reacted with a very big stress response that would kick in whenever I was in school and was called on. For example, my brain would freeze up, but the moral discourse would say, oh, it doesn't matter what your feelings are. Just make the right decision. And that just didn't make sense. And so I started reading around and found all sorts of literatures that informed my my view, and realized that we are really not very moral, that the small band hunter-gatherers are much more moral than we, that neurobiology shows that early experience matters for all sorts of outcomes in adulthood and throughout life. That the neuroscience shows that certain parenting practices that the anthropologists identified in small band hunter-gatherers are the ones that we expect as babies. Babies shouldn't be crying. They don't cry in those communities, and they aren't left alone. That all sorts of parenting practices that we are now studying in my lab. So it's just been a journey of finding different information, you know, being open to the muse, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call that powerful draw to information and experience that I've just now put together into this larger framework, figuring out what was wrong with me and how to get back to being more human, because I think what we build now are subhumans or inhumane creatures who don't know how to be present with others. And so what happens, the theory that that's explained in the book, among other theories, is that when you get stressed in early life by not getting your needs met, so when you leave a baby to cry, you leave them to sleep alone, that's very stressful to the baby because they should be in the womb another 18 months compared to other animals, that we are really like fetuses when we're born, and so much of the brain is yet left to develop. And those parameters of all sorts of systems, how they're going to work, is very much established during those first few years of life. And so if you don't get what you need, you start to develop a brain that's not very agile, that's not very intelligent, not very emotionally intelligent or practically intelligent, doesn't fit in. And so you turn into towards more of a social opposition. Your parents are opposed to you because they're not giving you what you needed. And so you set up this distrust of the world. You withdraw, maybe what we call in psychology is dissociate when you feel threatened, or you aggress. So you shift between one up, one down, dominant, submission. And your brain just learns to do that as a matter of course very quickly and easily. And so we get black and white thinking, you know, fundamentalisms. That's the kind of stuff that comes out of this poor early experience. And it's not what we see, the kind of morality we see in these small band hunter-gatherers. I'm going on and on here. I hope the second, what we do see, what our promise is, our moral inheritances. And Darwin pointed to what our moral sense was and how important it was in evolution compared to natural selection. He was toying with the idea that it might be more important for humans, but we've undermined that moral sense that he identified through the tree of life. But what it includes is this great sense of empathy and compassion towards others, the ability to be present with others and co-construct the dance of the moment with that other person. That's what I call the engagement ethic. And then it also means using your imagination, your executive functions, your higher order thinking in a communal way. And so that means, you know, understanding that what you're doing is going to affect the seventh generation from now, understanding that we're all connected. Everything is a one, and you're just one of many members of the community. And so what happens, though, when you undermine development and you focus in on allow kids to be undercared for, they don't use their imagination for communalism. They use it for self-protection. So they build their weapon systems. They try to control other people in all sorts of ways, a kind of empire orientation. I'm going to help you, but you're really trying to, you know, just control the world. Or you detach. You go into the ivory tower. A lot of faculty members do this, right? They're not thinking about their relationships, what their impact is on all the relationships they have with every entity on the earth. They just go into their, you know, little dissociative tower and do their work. So you have then in Western society, you've got a combination of viciousness, of imposing your will, our culture, the dominant culture, and all the other cultures of the earth, because it's better. It's good for you. It's democracy. You know, it's economic development. You've got that going on. At the same time, you've got this detachedness, this inability to be present with that biodiversity, that biocultural diversity that used to exist all over the world. And so you have a kind of a deadness. You've moved, you don't have that capacity in the right hemisphere, which develops in early life, to be present, to be engaged, to understand the connection. And you then have to use your self-protective primitive survival systems to react to things and your imagination that then serves your own ends. So we've twisted everything around. We think it's normal now. This is what humans are like. They're selfish, aggressive, and, you know, can't get along. That's just normal. No, it's not.
So, yeah, I think everything you're saying is just fantastic, and in the good sense. And what you've talked about this, I mean, you know, I've written 20 some books about this culture's destructiveness, and you know, honestly, it still doesn't make any sense to me. And it seems to me that one of the central arguments you're making is that one of the reasons that the culture is so messed up is because, like you said, we're not getting what we need as children. So can you be a bit more? You've talked about this some, but can you be more, a bit more, even more explicit about what child rearing practices would lead to children who are more human, and what are more of the practices that are leading to the creation of little capitalists and little selfish gene promoters?
Yes. So we study what we call the evolved developmental niche. It's the early nest. Every animal has one for its young. The nest that we developed emerged initially with the social mammals over 30 million years ago. 30 million years. And it essentially evolved to fixation, which means that there's not much no changes were made because it was working so well to optimize the adaptive capacities of our ancestors in the mammal chain, social mammal chain. So humans intensified it. As humans, this is how the assumptions go. We became bipedal, walking on two legs, and the pelvis shrank, and so babies had to be born earlier. And so we, especially as primates, need much more care than other primates because our brains have so much left to develop because we didn't stay in the womb long enough to develop those things.
Wait. I'm sorry. Can you back up a second and talk a little bit more about this this nest in terms of, like, give a couple examples, like, for, I don't know, just make them up, elk or walruses or elephants. I don't care. I just to be really clear on what you're saying.
Well, can I go through the characteristics and then I can make comparisons?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes, please.
So our nest then includes breastfeeding. Then we're mammals, right? That's what mammals do. That's where the name comes from, giving breast milk to their young. And our need, and we can compare them let me just say these characteristics are that I'm going to list and talk about are based on what the anthropologists have identified in small band hunter-gatherer communities all over the world. Wherever they are, these are the common practices, which means they're part of our human backdrop, our evolutionary history, because these cultures don't communicate necessarily. I mean, it's just the practices, and they've very similar to the social mammal practices over 30 million years old. So breast milk is one, and it's extensive breastfeeding for humans. On average, it's weaning at age 4. So that means at least 4 years of breastfeeding, because our immune systems are not finished till around age 5 or so. And breast milk has all the immunoglobulins you need to build the immune system and the brain and all sorts of, it's got thousands of ingredients in it. Now our milk is thin. And so you have to be fed frequently. It has high lactose in it rather than predator milk is thick. So they have to go off and hunt for all day long and they have to leave their young behind in the nest. Tigers or bears, not bears, but other predators are going to leave their young behind. And so they have to have milk that's going to last for a while. And so it's a different, animals have different types of milk. Ours is thin, needs to be ingested all the time, frequently, because it's building the brain, building the immune system that's growing rapidly. So, you know, thousands of synapses in a second are being grown in the baby's brain. So another characteristics is touch, and touch is common to mammals, need lots of positive touch from their parents or other caregivers. For humans, it's also other adult caregivers that carry around the baby. And we know from neurobiological studies of animals, we can do all sorts of studies on rats and mice who have similar brain structures in part to ours. And we know that touch, there's critical windows for touch. So if you're a rat and you have a high nurturing mother in the first 10 days of your life, which is like the first 6 months for a baby, a human baby, your mother will be licking you a lot. And for humans, it would be carrying you a lot and holding you. Then what happens is genes that control anxiety will get turned on properly, will express themselves properly. Whereas if you have a low nurturing mother, those genes never get turned on properly. And for the rest of your life, then you are going to be anxious when new things happen. So we can see parallels with young humans as well. It's hard to do, you know, we can't do experiments on humans, so we have to do them on animals and then draw the conclusions from there. So that's breast milk, breastfeeding, touch, responsiveness is another one. This one's the most studied in psychology, where the mother or other caregivers respond to the needs of the baby before letting them get distressed. In traditional societies, this means paying attention to when the baby's making a face or starting to wiggle funny, and then you adjust. Whereas in the West, we think you have to wait till the baby cries, which is a little too late because they've already gotten distressed. And when you have a distressed baby, what it's doing is now undermining positive development and going towards trying to stay safe. And so it's feeding and fueling the older parts of the brain, the ones that are you're born with, the survival systems and the stress response. Whereas what you're supposed to be growing in the early years is this positive social networks of learning how to share an emotional space with another, limbic resonance, intersubjectivity. These are all kind of the big words. It's that back and forth communication that you have. You know, you feel like your forehead is glowing when you have that. It's like a mind melding. That's what the baby's supposed to be experiencing and synchronizing with others, the social back and forth. That's the mutual responsiveness in that way and in other ways that are, you know, more physical are part of what grows the brain well. And we can see that then in kids that receive good care, even in the West. They have parents who are more mutually responsive. Okay, so we've got breastfeeding, touch, responsiveness. Then there's play. Mammals play. Whenever they feel well, young mammals are playing. You can tell it's a good way to check whether they feel afraid or are sick. You know they're fine when they start to play. And play builds the capacities for controlling aggression, for social skills, for knowing how far to go with others, and builds you know, the capacity not to need ADHD drugs. So that's another one. So, and then we have multiple adult caregivers. I mentioned that. So in some of these societies, small band hunter-gatherers, it's not the mother who's taking care of the baby 50% of the time, it's other adults. And so that it's a community, village kind of child-raising approach. And then finally, two more, I guess. One is soothing birth experiences. So that means, you know, not separating the mother and baby at birth, not inducing any pain. We know these things traumatize the brain and push it into a direction of self-protection. And instead, you know, in the States here, in Britain, where there's lots of trauma that's induced in hospital births now. It's just amazing. And the last one is positive social climate, so that the child is able to get a positive response from others and feel supported and like they belong. And in all these areas, virtually all of them, the USA has been going downhill. I mean, you could say, well, there's been ups and downs. That's true, depending on what you're looking at. But we have really cut back on most of the positive support systems for kids.
So it sounds to me like part of what you're – I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like part of what you're suggesting is that capitalism, the notion that nature is red in tooth and claw, much of our philosophy is a result or one result of improper child-rearing practices.
Yes. I know it sounds rather grand and strange, but yes, I do think that because when you don't, I mean, we're almost, we're really autistic compared to small band hunter-gatherers, especially ecologically autistic. We just don't understand, can't conceive, can't communicate, can't receive the communications. And we're not very, you know, skilled with each other even now. And so I think when you don't, it's like people who have right hemisphere brain damage, they'll say, what's all this with the eyes? They never look at eyes because they don't get anything from people's eyes because they miss all the little subtle communications from eye contact. They're missing it. And I think it's sort of that way for us. We're missing all this information because, and then when you don't understand it, you just make up a new, you know, worldview to support what you think the world is about, which is very degraded.
Well, one of the things that I love about one of the many things I love about your work is that, you know, I've thought for a long time that, you know, Judith Herman's work and all of her work around complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's been very clear to me that we have an entire culture suffering from complex PTSD.
Yeah.
And that much of this culture's philosophy, science, all of this are manifestations of this. But one of the things I love about your work is that it's, I think, more, even more formative than what I was just suggesting, in that it doesn't take somebody being beaten to end up with this level of course, Judith Herman doesn't actually suggest it takes beatings to get complex PTSD. One can simply be held a prisoner. But what you're suggesting, it seems to me, is that is much more profound and foundational than what I'm suggesting, in that it's not merely overt acts of violence or even holding somebody in that tight control, but instead it's also a lack of, let's go back to what you said early on and maybe explore this just a little bit more about how we're born 18 months, quote, too early. Do you think you've covered that enough, or is there more you want to say about that? Because I think that's really profound and important too.
Yeah, I think what we need from parents then, and then they need the support of the community to do this. We know from the various studies that Sarah Hurdy has done that mothers don't pay attention to their children as well if the community is not supportive of them doing that. And we've undermined mothers' kind of receptivity to their children now by pushing them into the workplace and saying, you're not really a person unless you work and be a mother. So, the 18-month thing, that's rather shocking, I think. We certainly, and I think people also push back and say, what, you're going to do this to women and, barefoot and pregnant again? No. This is a community event. A child raising is for the community to do. And so we have to organize ourselves in a way that it can be done well. So the 18 months means that we have a lot of power over that child. You know, Alice Miller, the psychotherapist, has written a number of books about early trauma and points out in one of them about she studies Hitler's early childhood. But she points out how many child-rearing advice books from the last few centuries point to advise parents to really severely hurt their young children before age 3 because they won't remember it. And they won't remember that it came from the parents. But then they can have control, full control over that child. So obedience, you punish them until their spirit is broken, essentially. And then you have full obedience for whatever you want, and they'll do whatever you say. And she puts this on into the Nazi kind of way of child rearing. So I think what we need from parents, though, at these ages is a yielding to the needs of the baby, yielding to whatever it is that child indicates they want. And that means also that the medical professions who help with birthing have to be very cautious and careful and kind and compassionate, because everything they do is having an effect on that child's trajectory. And so in a way, we have to build love back into our system. I mean, I don't like systems either. But if we're going to have a system, it's got to be built around love and supporting that kind of neurobiology of love.
Wait, so you're actually suggesting that we as a society and we in our communities love children?
Yes. But you've got all these I'm saying we have to do it better. I think parents are so traumatized themselves, and if they don't deal with their own trauma explicitly, if they don't consciously realize I was traumatized as a child, or I have insecure attachment, and work through it to some degree, they're going to pass it on subconsciously to their child. So they're going to pass on their trauma to the next generation unless they get some help or take it on, their self-authorship to revamp who they are and build the more compassionate orientation to their children.
So obviously this culture is killing the planet, and we need to stop capitalism, we need to stop civilization, we need all those things. But setting all that aside for a moment, let's say there's somebody listening to this who is a single mother of of two older children and now a younger child, or one older child and now just had another baby, but she has to pay the rent. So what can she do to begin? What can she do to promote the sort of healthy child that you're talking about, given that she lives under this capitalist system? What can she do individually, and what can we do as a community to support that child? What can happen in the short term? Obviously, once again, if we don't stop capitalism and civilization, the planet is dead. But leaving that aside and talking about this child, what should be done?
Well, I would, you know, this is the conundrum. And if you just think about an individual, what we have to do, and I think what we are in a way maybe encouraged to do anyway, the individualism focus here, is to set up your own support system. And so that would mean hanging out with other mothers and exchanging babysitting or childcare or meal preparation, living with others who are going to help you with that. Now, I know it's hard with traumatized people who have families, extended families that are traumatizing. So you have to find a way. And I think maybe the church communities is a place to start. You have to pick the right church, of course. Some of them are also very traumatizing. And that would be a way to at least move into and pray, lots of praying and for, you know, whatever that is, of drawing the people to you that you need to support your child's development. And the community, we need to, you know, in some places like in China, at least they used to have a nurse on every block that would help the families, France, with their healthcare system. I mean, we need parental leave for everyone. For sure. But in France, they also have nurses coming by every week after baby's born. They have people doing your laundry. You know, other places let you lie in for a month and treat you special as a mother. I mean, it's really quite a big transition, this, especially the first child. And so we've sort of just denied mothering even. That's my next conference. So next fall, I have one. I host one every 2 years. And next fall, it's on sustainable wisdom, integrating indigenous know-how for global flourishing. And we've got 20 speakers lined up, mostly indigenous from around the world. And then 2 years later, I'm going to do one on returning to mothering, because we have neglected that. And I mean, we need to mother each other and mother the earth and let the earth mother us. So it's a big topic, too.
So what another question that comes up is so given that listeners to this are probably going to be more than 18 months old themselves, and given that their neurobiology has been affected already, what can be done later to let's presume that someone has already gone through this culture's mill for the first 18 months. What can be done to help after that point?
Yeah, the longest chapter in my book, my neurobiology book, is about that, what to do. And you have various issues. So I think there's three things to do, essentially. One is to calm those survival systems. So the anxiety, depression, anger systems, use mindfulness, meditation, and other kinds of deep breathing and various things like that to help yourself learn to calm down and stay calm, because you can't really do anything unless you're calm. But that's not enough for our optimizing our relationships and our morality. You've got to then build social pleasure, build the pro-social systems that should have been grown in the first 5 years of your life. And build those skills there. And that then takes, and that's very right hemisphere directed. And the right hemisphere can grow throughout life. And it grows from experiences of art, play, music, dance. And those are the kinds of things then you can immerse yourself in order and make it a social kind of experience. And then you start to build those systems and start to break through and rewire your brain, essentially. And then the third area then is to also expand your imagination, to start to find your place in the local landscape and feel connected, communally connected to all the non-humans around you as well as the humans, and find ways to use your imagination to grow those relationships and their well-being as well as your own.
You know, we were talking earlier about the first 18 months in terms of what is necessary from the parents and the larger community to the child. Do you want to talk about the importance of connection to non-humans or to the land during early childhood too?
Yes, I don't do that in the book. That's the next area that I'll be working on. But yes, there are some traditions in Siberia, for example, where the baby is placed out on the taiga, in the landscape, and allowed to just look around and move around and even interact with wild animals, because they're the assumption is that those animals are pals in a way of that child, and they won't hurt the child because the child doesn't approach with any kind of malintent. And so I think what we probably wouldn't be comfortable with allowing our children to hang out with wild animals, and we've so destroyed their generations that they're not going to be very trusting either. So I think, though, having wilderness experiences, going out and, camping and being outside and just, paying attention to the winds, to the trees, to the insects, and feeling connected and letting children have that time and space to feel connected. And they do. It's just that when we pull them back inside and pull them away from their imaginations and their impulses to be in the outside in nature, that they start to lose that, and then we kind of suppress it in them through schooling.
John Livingston wrote about how he thinks that we are, for the most part, horribly in situations of horrible sensory deprivation, because we evolved hearing birds and trees and everybody else, but at this point, for most of us, most of our sensory perceptions are either created or mediated by humans. So we're in a bit of an echo chamber, and he thinks that when you're in echo chambers, you begin to hallucinate, and he thinks most of our philosophies are the hallucinations of somebody in. That's how we can come to believe the stock market is more important than the real world, is because we attend to the stuff. We hear about only human stuff all the time. So I would also think that even currently, simply carrying one's child outside, and so the child gets to hear chickadees and gets to hear that instead of television or instead of, just simply human created music, I would think that would also have a pretty profound influence.
Yes, I agree. They need to have the immersed experience. That's how you build expertise in any area. You've got to have the real life lived experience of it. And that's what we need our children to have. And instead of sitting them inside, which most kids do now, instead of playing outside, parents are afraid now to let their kids out. Study showed that they let children play away from the house 1/9 the distance that they allowed in 1970, when the crime rate was about the same.
Yeah, and I also read that the average kid spends like 8 minutes a day outside or something like that. And I know from my own childhood that basically I would leave after breakfast and, go out, oftentimes just, spend the entire day out in the pastures and in the irrigation ditch and everything else, and then come back in time for lunch and leave again and come back in time for dinner. When I'm an infant, obviously, when I'm, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah, yeah. Lucky you.
Yeah. Well, I think that was the same was true for all my friends too, that this was the time. So we have about 5 minutes left. And so first, if somebody hears this interview, what would you like for them to take away as the, there'll be a couple more questions, but the first question is, what would you want them to take away as, I heard this great interview today. It was about, and then they give like a 2-sentence condensation of of your message, what would you condense it down to, the take-home point? The thing they really know in their heart and the thing that does change their being.
Well, that's it, I think, is to open your mind and heart to the information that we are not, the humans you see around you today are not fully human yet, and that there are things we can do. You don't have to stay here. You can shift your mindset into this communal connectedness. People do that with meditation and other practices. And when you shift into that mindset, you realize that it doesn't matter. Some of the things that you worry about now don't really matter as much. You know, that we are part of this planet. The planet is not going to disappear. What's going to disappear is our species and the vertebrate species. And we're going to kill off a lot of species, but the planet is mostly biomass. It's going to continue without us. So I think we have to realize that the other thing that calms me is that even if when I die or even if our species disappears, we're going to still be part of the earth because all of our dust becomes other animals and other creatures and other life forms. So it's just that there's the beauty of what's here now that we've been destroying for some time now, but what beauty is in our species, what beauty is in on our planet, depends on us realizing that we are something other than what you see now and that we can restore it.
So my next question is going, and thank you for that. And my next question is going a completely different direction, sort of, which is, if you suddenly became the queen of all things motherhood in this culture and you could put in place some policy changes, what would you can't get rid of capitalism the first day, you can't get rid of civilization, you can't put us back into small band gathering the first day. You know, we'll worry about that a little bit down the road. Within the current system, what sort of changes would you want to facilitate the emergence of more human children? Like, you've talked about the importance of bonding and the importance, you've talked about a couple of them, you know, what's going on in France. If they made you in charge of this in the United States, what policy changes would you make tomorrow to bring about the sort of child rearing that you want?
Well, I would want parental leave. First 1 year, and then I'd like to extend it to 3 years that the father and mother share. Then I would like to shift the society around family well-being, whatever family it is, whatever construction, whatever combination of parents, children, extended family, that becomes the center. And we worry about household well-being instead of corporate well-being. We build things so that play is easily had by all, that they feel like they can be responsive to their children, to each other, that we are part of a community of support systems rather than have all the money go up to the top. It's already set up so that every community is supportive of their families and their members.
Because it seems to me that this insecurity that you've been talking about that can happen from early on ends up manifesting in every mode of this culture, where you end up with economic insecurity, you end up with personal insecurity, you end up with the notion that nature is red in tooth and claw and that you have to have a war against nature. It seems to me it's one of the things I'm just loving about everything you say, is that it has these incredibly profound social implications. And I think the word profound is too weak. It has pervasive and overriding social implications, everything you're saying.
Yeah. One other thing I would want to do is stop allowing people to own living things. Parents should not be the owners of their children. People who live on a piece of land should not be the owners of the trees and life forms on that land and do whatever they want with them. No, no, no. We cannot take other people's lives as if it doesn't, other people and non-human entities' lives, as if they have no purpose, as if they have no life course of their own. We've gotten caught in this understanding of life as manifest. Whatever is not manifest, we ignore, right? That's the science mindset. that if you can't measure it, it doesn't exist. If you can't see it, it doesn't exist. If you don't aren't aware of it, it doesn't exist. And we've narrowed capacity, human capacity, so much, so in such tiny form now. It's like, you know, virtually all of reality we're missing. We assume that because we can only hear a certain bandwidth or see a certain bandwidth, that that's what is real. But we have all these non-humans who have many more capacities than we do. We hardly understand them. But the indigenous worldview, the indigenous societies do have this understanding. We need to go back to how they live and integrate that with our technologies in some fashion, which is what I have to work on in the next year.
So last question is there anything you've wanted to say that I haven't asked you the right question for? Is there anything else you want to say?
Well, I just that there's always hope. I think it's pretty bleak that we have brought ourselves to this cliff and we're falling over the cliff at the moment. But I always pray and hope that and believe that we can step back, that even if a small portion of our species survives, that they can find their way back to being Earth creatures, to being part of this beautiful place that is Earth and that is part of the universe.
Well, thank you so much for everything you say, and thank you for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Darsha Narvaez. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.